museums, mostly on Museum Island, formed by the Spree River forking and reuniting, and I visited them several times in the past decades. Your skills remain unparalleled, I said to Flittish by way of thanks. I'll leave you to your search for suitable leathers. I said farewell, returned to the trees of Petrine Hill, and shifted through Tiernanog to Tiergarten in Berlin, a pleasant and rather large wooded park with paths that radiated out from the famous Victory Column. The old tree bound there was a knotted, lichen-covered sycamore, currently occupied by an alarmed red squirrel, which Oberon saw immediately and lunged after, nearly catching it by the tail before it scampered up the trunk out of reach.
Aw, oh, dang it! Almost got him, and I would have too if he weren't so squirrely.
Maybe next time, Oberon.
That's right,
Oberon said, more to the squirrel than to me. He still had his front paws on the tree trunk, and his eyes tracked the one that got away. He barked for emphasis.
Don't just wait for next time, pal! Your doom approaches! Say goodbye to your nuts!
There was an efficient train system nearby called the S-Bahn, which would take us to Hakkasche Markt in only 4 stops. But since it was the evening rush hour, and everyone was returning home from work, the cars were far too crowded to sneak Oberon on board. We had to go on foot, and that was all right. We needed time for full darkness to fall anyway. We jogged in gray twilight through the outskirts of Tiergarten, with only a brief pause while Oberon tried and failed to catch a couple of rabbits, and then past blocks of flats and office buildings covered in unimaginative graffiti. Halfway to our destination, it began to rain, the sort that couldn't decide if it wanted to be sleet or not. It was more piercingly cold than refreshing, and I was grateful for the jacket. I distracted Oberon from the weather with the memory that somewhere nearby there was a road whose name, Große Hamburgerstraße, translated to Big Hamburger Street.
Really? What's the story behind that?
I don't know if there is a story, I said. It most likely meant that road was a fairly wide one that led to the city of Hamburg, but Oberon wouldn't find that interesting. If there isn't, we should make one.
Can you at least buy a big hamburger there?
I believe so. It would be a tragic waste of natural marketing if not. It was dismal, cold, and dark when we arrived at the Monbijou Hotel, a modern building in cream and sporting a cool gray logo above the revolving glass door. I peeked into the interior from outside. Directly opposite the door was a lift, one of the narrow but deep elevators, more commonly found in Europe. The reception area was to the left, complete with a primly uniformed employee, and to the right, a fireplace beckoned, inviting people to sit at the small round tables scattered about. It was a lounge area, with the bar no doubt secreted out of sight from the street, and several people were already busy lounging in it. They were lounging, in fact, in an almost ostentatious manner, as if to say to passers-by like myself, "Look upon my exquisite lounging, foolish mortal, and mourn that you will never lounge with such cosmopolitan savoir-faire." I flipped my vision to the magical spectrum and saw that 3 of the 4 people were not human. They had gray auras around their heads and hearts with a fiery red center, which meant they were vampires. None wore infrared goggles, so that was encouraging. The only human I could see appeared nervous, with ample justification. I thought at first that I would enter in camouflage and simply go to work, but that wouldn't be wise. They'd be warned by a revolving door moving by itself. I camouflaged only Oberon instead, and had him follow me inside. Once I got to the lobby, I veered left toward the reception area, so as not to invite a closer look. They might smell my old blood anyway, but if I gave them no cause to examine the air, I might buy myself a few more seconds of surprise. "Oberon, I want you to stay over here and dry off," I said, pointing to the couches in the reception area. No one was there except for the single employee behind the reception half-circle desk. Untouched German newspapers and magazines waited to be perused on an expansive black leather ottoman. "Be quiet and don't come after me. I'm gonna pick a fight and don't want you in danger. These are very strong vampires.
But I can help. Remember that one time I helped you against that vampire?
Yes, you did help, but you also got hurt. This is different. That time before, the vampires ambushed me and I needed your help. This time, I'm ambushing them. If I don't have to worry about your safety, that'll be a tremendous help to me.
Okay. I could use a nap anyway. That way I'd be helping both of us.
I think that's an excellent plan, I replied, though I didn't think he'd feel like napping once the fighting started. Let's get you hidden behind this furniture here, so the guy at the front desk doesn't see you. Then I can drop your camouflage and use that energy for kicking ass.
Sounds like a plan.
I waved casually to the receptionist and pretended to be interested in a newspaper while Oberon got himself stretched out on the floor out of sight. Once the receptionist lost interest in me and dropped his eyes, I dispelled the camouflage on Oberon and cast it on myself instead.
Nap well, I told him, but guard my jacket.
I kind of liked it, and it was sure to get messy in a few minutes. I took it off and laid it on the ottoman. As soon as it left my hands, I dropped its camouflage, but the receptionist didn't notice its sudden appearance. I took Lukta's steak out of the inside pocket.
But I can yap and guard at the same time. If somebody comes around here, they'll see me and decide to let that sleeping dog and your jacket lie.
I returned my sight to the magical spectrum and crossed the lobby to the lounge on the other side. Through the open doorway, the lounge continued quite far back to a bar and then to an area with restaurant seating where the hotel served its breakfast. In the lounge, round tables rested in front of couches built into the wall, and on the opposite side of those tables were a few modern armless chairs right out of a Copenhagen design house. 10 tables, seating 3 or 4 each, and they were all full. 30 vampires, and one very nervous human serving them drinks they did not touch, though I had serious doubts that she knew who or what she was serving. She only knew that something about this group seemed wrong. Up to this point, I had slain very few vampires myself. Most of the war had been conducted for me by the human or the hammers of God. Unless these vampires were all very old, they had yet to see why vampires of early days had cause to fear druids, except perhaps for Theophilus. I did hope that he was there. I had no idea what he looked like, and their auras all appeared the same to me, so I had no way to identify which one was measurably older or more powerful than another. I shifted my grip on the stake, carved with the unbinding that would undo the vampire's magic, and then forcibly separate their component elements. I was anxious to try it out here, since it never got a test run in Prague. I'd examined the bindings earlier, and it was a clever execution. If there was no vampirism to unbind, it would do nothing to a human but hurt every bit as much as a normal stabbing would. But for a vampire, stabbing it anywhere with this stake would end its undead existence. Murmuring the bindings to increase my strength and speed, drawing all the energy from the pool stored in my bear charm, I hoped I'd be able to either end this quickly or else lure them outside, where I could tap into more power from the earth. But I had my semi-effective unbinding charm, my ability to verbally unbind them, my stake, and at least a temporary visual advantage. I really wished I knew how to tell the older vampires from the younger ones. Cosmetically, they were all frozen at the age they were when they died, and their clothing didn't give any clues either. They all wore bespoke Italian suits and expensive shoes. I would not be surprised if each vampire's ensemble was worth a year's salary to the average worker. And younger was a relative term. I thought of it as younger than Theophilus and myself, but I had no doubt that every one of those vampires was a few hundred years old. Age equaled prestige in the vampire world, and truly young vampires would not be allowed to accompany Theophilus. They spoke Italian, too. A good clue that this crew had spent at least some time near the vampire power center of Rome, from which the campaign against the druids had originated millennia ago. So when one vampire, seated against the wall and facing the door,
lifted his nose and said,
Sentite l'odore di quel sangue? È veramente strano.
That was my cue to get the slaughter started, because they had smelled me. I mentally targeted that vampire and surged forward, coming up behind the seated vamp and plunging the stake down over the back of the chair and into his right shoulder, puncturing the suit and his flesh. He made a short, gurgling noise before his body liquefied and squirted in five directions, out his pant legs, his shirt sleeves, and his collar. I repeated the exercise with the vampire next to him, and then completed the verbal unbinding on the third, taking out three vampires in a little more than 3 seconds. And then, while the rest of the room was figuring out that, hey, maybe something ugly was going on, I staked another two and unbound three more verbally, using a macro binding and simply changing the target. It was 6 or 7 seconds, therefore, before the back of the room figured out that something was taking them apart, and the champion lounging session was over. They all sprang to their feet, in some cases knocking over tables and chairs, and in one specific case, throwing a chair in my general direction. It moved fast, and I wasn't expecting it, and it took me down, though it did no real damage apart from giving them more time to set themselves in defense. I gave zero fucks about that. Vampires had no true defense against druidry, and I was gonna thunderdome every single one of them. I kept retargeting and unbinding the vampires closest to me. The nearest two lunged in my direction, came apart, and showered me in blood. My camouflage was then useless because I was silhouetted in red, so I dispelled it and kept unbinding as I climbed to my feet. I'd ended 10 vampires in 15 seconds. Perhaps I could get the rest in under a minute. A whole furniture set sailed through the air at my head, the vampires figuring that if it had worked once, perhaps it would work again. And it did, because dodging that many chairs and tables is impossible. I crumpled underneath them, making sure to hold on to the stake, and the 20 remaining vampires charged for the exit. Most of them flowed around me, but a pair landed on top of the chairs, pinning me to the floor and allowing the others time to escape. Or at least that was their plan. I targeted each one in turn and unbound them. The weight lifted off me, and their entrails glopped onto the floor. I threw off the chairs just in time to see that there were only 5 or so vampires remaining in the room. The rest had scarpered off, but one landed on me with his knee in my gut, one hand around my throat, and the other pinning down my stake hand. He was strong and would crush my larynx if I let him get comfortable. His nails were already drawing blood. I triggered the unbinding charm on my necklace, imperfect as it was, and let it do its thing. It affected the vampire like a punch to the solar plexus, and he wheezed, the strength temporarily gone from his limbs. I wrenched the stake hand free and slammed it into his side beneath the ribs as his buddies scrambled past. He turned into something like melted raspberry gelato right on top of me, and I was so glad that I'd left my jacket with Oberon. I gasped and coughed to get my breath back, then scrambled to my feet. Even though without oxygen, my muscles felt like jello. The time I'd spent on the ground had let the vampires crash through the front floor-to-ceiling windows. They didn't bother with the revolving door, meaning that almost half of them were getting away. A faintly heard, "Scheisse!" from behind the bar was my only clue that the human server had survived.
"Medicus, you all right?"
Oberon's voice asked in my head.
"Yep, I'll be back. Take your nap."
Jumping through the jagged portal of glass, I saw that the vampires had split into two groups. One had gone left at a diagonal angle toward the S-Bahn station at Hakkashamacht, and another had gone right toward Monbijou Park and the Spree River. Considering my low reserves of energy, I hauled off after the group to the right, since chasing them through the park would allow me to reconnect with Gaia and replenish. There was a flower bed, now sad and brown for the winter, surrounding a pedestal with a bust of somebody on top staring with blank bronze eyes at me. The straggling vampire in the back was approaching it as I unbound him. He exploded and covered the statue in gore. It said Shamiso underneath the bust, and I recognized it as I passed.
"Hey! Adalbert von Shamiso! Sup, Bert?"
I'd helped him, back in the day, to discover and classify some flower species. He was a good guy. I didn't realize he'd been so well thought of in Berlin. And it's not every botanist who gets a statue made of him.
"Sorry about the vampire guts, big guy."
I caught 5 more, able to move faster than them, with Gaia's aid.
four in the park, and the last one in the Spree River. He jumped in out of desperation and disappeared underwater. Since he didn't need to breathe, he wouldn't come up until he was good and ready. But that same lack of buoyancy made vampires terrible swimmers. They sank to the bottom and had to walk instead of swim, much slower than anything else. He couldn't float up. He'd have to claw and crawl his way out, if I ever let him get that far. I splashed after him, shape-shifted to a sea otter, swam right out of my clothes, and held the stake between my wee front paws until I was able to close the gap between us. Then I shifted back to human and sank the stake into the vampire's calf. He dissolved in the river beneath the Boda Museum and got washed away by the current. That left me naked in the Spree River, and I'm not ashamed to say the temperature led to some shrinkage. That was 19 very old vampires erased from the world, however, and all I got was naked and some bruising. Not bad. Quite good, in fact. And if one of the Unbound had been Theophilus, then I would count it as a perfect ambush. But 11 of them had escaped cleanly to the S-Bahn, and there was no telling where they had gone. I returned to the Mon Bijou Hotel in shivering camouflage to avoid alarming the local populace. My priorities amused me, and I snorted into the darkness. I had no problem disassembling vampires in plain view, but didn't want to truly terrify anyone with my full frontal nudity. Once outside the hotel, I called Oberon to come join me outside. "And bring my jacket, will you please?" I asked.
"Okay. Ah, and the man working at the desk just saw me get up and he freaked out. I don't know what he's saying, but he's got those terrified Twilight Zone eyes."
Sirens began to wail and grow closer. "Yes, I imagine so. He just saw a man crash through the window, and if he's been in the lounge, he's seen an awful lot of blood. The sudden appearance of a huge hound, after all that, probably made him lose bladder control." We scooted around the corner to a Nike store on Hakusha Markt, where I was able to discreetly snatch a pair of sweatpants and a shirt. I didn't bother with shoes, and the leather jacket didn't exactly match, but it was better than bare skin in this weather. I made a mental note to come back and pay for them later.
"Let's head back to the park, Oberon. You have a fateful date with a squirrel."
"Yeah, that's right."
I wondered how the hotel staff would explain to the police what had happened. I wondered if maybe I'd been caught on a security video, unbinding vampires, a distinct possibility, and one I hadn't worried about as I had in the past. If that encounter was recorded, it could prove problematic, but I doubted it would make the news. There were too many uncomfortable questions for police to answer. Did I have a new horrifying weapon that liquefied or exploded people on contact? Or were those victims not exactly human? Or both? They couldn't let that get out until they had the answers. Governments have been in the habit of suppressing information for the population's own protection for centuries now. It's how gods and monsters can still walk the earth, and the mass of humanity thinks of them as mere stories for their entertainment, an escape from a lifetime of toil to pay the bills. Maybe they would call in the real-life equivalent of Fox Mulder to investigate this. Or the authorities might be so desperate to catch me that I would find a screen cap of my face on every television in Germany. Either way, the vampires who escaped wouldn't remain in Berlin for long, and I figured I shouldn't either. A hot shower, a real change of clothes, and a few hours of blissful slumber far away from sirens were what I needed. A reunion with Granuel would be perfect, if I could catch up with her. But we had no home base until the place in Oregon was ready. And I doubted I'd be able to divine her location now if she'd secured a divination cloak from the Polish coven, as Pirun had suggested. Not that I had my divination wands on me anyway.
"I'm up for sleeping someplace warm," I told Oberon as we jogged back to Tiergarten in the rain. "We need to visit the southern hemisphere."
"Fine by me. How about someplace dry in Australia? Alice Springs?"
"That sounds perfect right now."
Chapter 20. Knowing that there's something he should be doing, but can't, is like having an itchy arsehole you want to scour clean, but you're at court, and that sort of thing is frowned upon. I should be helping Briet hunt down Fand and Manannan MacLear, but I have apprentices to protect and teach. I suppose I should take comfort in the fact that this is something I can and should do. It should be feckin' joyous. I think it would be, except for me itching. I tried to tell Briet what happened, but her gaggle of fae chamberlains wouldn't rouse her. She was excessively wearied after some trip to Svartal fame, they said. She left explicit instructions not to be disturbed unless an actual physical attack was underway, and me wishing to speak to her didn't qualify. So I wrote a note. And I don't try to see Flidish about the problem, because what if it really isn't Flidish I'm talking to, but Fand in a glamour? Best to let Briet deal with it as she wishes, when she wishes, and bear the ishin in the meantime. Divination is no help. I cast once, watch the birdies for some augury, and all I get is the vague idea that they're hiding in a swamp. But no indication of where that swamp might be. Not even if it's on this plain, or one of the Irish ones, or somewhere else. So it's work for me now, instead of worry. I've started the kids on both Latin and English. Nouns for the earth, and sky, and sun, and adjectives to describe them. Things like that. Verbs for things you can do outside, and we do those things, like run and eat lunch and smell pine needles. And I start them using Latin to talk to Colorado, phrases that they repeat verbatim, but backed by thoughts and images, to begin the process of separating headspaces. I'll start them on Irish in a couple of years. The house has an unfinished basement, and the park has been working on it during the day, and I've begun working on it for a couple of hours after dinner each night, warding it every way I know how. The promised help from Tiernanog hasn't arrived yet, but I hope it will soon. It's going to be a sanctuary for the kids during full moons and all other emergencies, like troops of trolls barging through your land, smelling like exactly the wrong cheese. We've already coached them in what the full moon drill is, after that troll business. Hal Hawk arrives around dinner time, with whiskey, and the new identity that Sheehan asked for. Ty and Sam are with him too, just being friendly, neighbourly pack leaders. But also because they're hoping for a finger of the bottle Hal brought. They get one, as Greta pulls out glasses for everyone and Hal pours. It's Middleton, which I'm told is very fine, and we all raise our glasses as Hal proposes a toast.
An impromptu wake for Sean Flanagan, a fine identity that got shut down in Toronto, and a welcome to the new Sheehan, who will henceforth walk the world as Connor Malloy, as soon as he pays me for the trouble.
There are wry chuckles at this. And I join in.
But mostly, this is a rare, fine drink with rarer, finer friends. It's my privilege to call you such.
I say, oi, lad. But everyone else says, hair, hair, H-E-A-R, or maybe hair, hair, H-E-R-E. And I don't understand why they would say either one. English has way too many feckin' homophones, and when you combine something like that with what might be a slang term or polite jargon, it's just not fair to lads like me trying to pick up the language. I'm getting much better with it already, but little things like that are probably going to keep me stepping on me own bollocks for years. Milton is as fine as reported, and then I offer everyone a spot of lamb stew and soda bread. It's fortunate that I made a great big batch, thinking we'd have leftovers. But with extra guests, it's just as well I erred on the side of generosity. And it's also a good thing, I decide, that Greta found a place much bigger than I thought we'd need. It has a huge dining room and extra seating in the kitchen area, so it's already a place people like to visit. We're all there. The apprentices, their parents, the translators, the park leaders, having a laugh and being happy when all the wolves freeze or put down their spoons and cock their heads, listening. Some of them look toward the big bay window leading to the backyard.
No!
Sam says, the instant before the glass shatters and bullets riddle the room. The parents instinctively place themselves in the line of fire, protecting the children, and they take a few rounds as a result. That's gonna trigger transformations for sure, and I'm not the only one to shout, "Full moon drill, go!" It's only me and a few parents who aren't werewolves, so it's our job to make sure the kids get safely down to the basement. The wee ones move fast and stay low to the ground. They already know they don't want to be anywhere around when their parents' bones start snapping and the teeth come out. We hear the snarls and cracks and howls of pain begin before we're out of the room, though. They're all turning, including Greta, and the gunfire continues and just accelerates the transformations, so they don't have time to tear off their clothes first. They're gonna rip right through them as they transform, and that'll increase the pain of it. The park is gonna be feckin' irate, and I almost feel sorry for whoever's doing this. I leave the kids in the basement with Tuya's mother, Meg, and she locks the silver-lined gate we installed at the bottom of the stairs. They have food and water down here and emergency buckets. They can last for days if need be, by which point the danger should be long over. Then I slip on my knuckles, cast camouflage, and exit out the front door while I'm hearing all kinds of ruckus going on in the back. The camouflage turns out to be a good idea, since some feckin' arse almost takes me head off with a bullet as soon as the door opens. I duck down and scramble to the side and search for who's responsible. There's a tall figure with a handgun maybe 40 yards away, and his hearing must be stellar because he fires two more rounds that come damn close. One grazes the back of me calf as I'm running. Balls to that! I need to change the rules on him. I tumble onto the front lawn and shuck off my shirt before shape-shifting to a kite, which lets me fall out of the pants. Another round hits the turf where my body was a second before the shift, and I hop away from there as quietly as I can. My torn shoulder muscles won't let me fly yet, but of all of my forms, this is also the quietest one on the ground. I make little bird hops in his direction, and he hears even that. But since he has no idea what's making the sound, he's aiming too high. A dart to the left, and then a leap up, extending me talons to latch on his right wrist, since he's left his whole arm out there for me to perch on. But it's not a gentle landing. I clutch as hard as I can, and that hand shears clean off, dropping onto the ground along with the gun. I'm expecting a scream or some cursing as I drop with it. But instead, the spooky lad hisses. And the blood pumping out of him is dark, like it would be when it starved for oxygen. I hop away, not caring about the noise I'm making now because he can't shoot me, and see him bend down to snatch up his right hand with his left. He doesn't give a damn about the gun anymore. He just jams that hand back onto his stump like it'll help, and then he turns and runs down the road leading to town. Fast. That's not a man, I realize. That's a damn vampire. We're being attacked by vampires! Feckin' Sheehan! I shift back to human, take off after him, and then I recite the words of unbinding before he can get out of range. The vampire comes apart with a witch sound as the elements of his body forcibly separate, and I pivot immediately to give the wolf pack some help behind the house. Sheehan said that we might get some vampire blowback from whatever he was doing, but I didn't expect anything like this. Guns, I mean. I haven't figured out how to ward against those. Are people with a basic understanding of tactics? You don't have to get into the house and pass my wards when you can shoot from outside them and get everyone to come to you. It's not in the nature of werewolves to sit behind walls. You poke them, and they're gonna hit back. Shoot them, and they won't rest until they have your entrails in their teeth. By the time I round the corner of the house, most of the gunfire has died down. It's close quarters fighting now, because the pack has streamed out of the house to make a meal out of whoever ruined dinner. Magical sight tells me there are 6 vampires and 1 human against 14 werewolves all told. When you count the parents and translators and the visiting pack leaders, I don't think they expected to be outnumbered 2-1. You'd have to be daft to think that would work out well. I think they were expecting just me and Greta. Maybe a couple more. The werewolves are all bleeding and completely savage. The vampires didn't use silver bullets, so all they did was make the wolves crazy. The only way to beat them is through silver, or to tear them up physically. It can be done, and it already has. One wolf is down and not moving, 2 legs ripped completely off, and its lower jaw missing. He's undergone his final shift, what Greta calls the termination clause of lycanthropy. For all the shit you have to endure while you live, at the end, it at least gives you back your humanity. It's Nergui, Tuya's father, lying there. Damn it. 2 vampires are down, and the rest are surrounded. I recognize the wolf forms of Sam, Ty, and Greta, but the rest are a mystery to me, since I've never sparred or run with them before. There was just that one brief time with the trolls, and I never figured out who was who. Sam, Ty, and Greta have formed a hunting group with a 4th wolf that might be Hal Hauk. He's the biggest of the big dogs. They're masterful, surrounding, nipping, timing their springs at the vampire so that he hardly has a chance to land a blow before he loses a chunk of flesh somewhere else. Once he goes down, he doesn't get up. Teeth lock on the throat and tear it. Then it's on to the next target. The 3 other vampires are surrounded by less experienced wolves. They might take longer to go down, but it's inevitable. The human is backpedaling away, shouting at the vampires in some sort of spitting language, and it's him the leader's target next. Something's dodgy about him. He's acting like he's the boss of their party, but I see nothing in the magical spectrum that would explain why 6 vampires were taking his orders. I turn off the sight as I get closer, and he's dressed strangely too. Not a commando outfit or any sort of modern warrior gear. He's wearing a suit with a brightly coloured scarf thing around his neck. I see the moment where he counts 4 wolves coming and understands that this is the end for him, and in the next instant, his grim determination to take somebody with him. I am too far away to do anything. All I can do is pray he won't be successful. The first big wolf leaps at him. He raises that gun of his, crying out in defiance, and shoots it point blank down the wolf's throat. The bullet explodes through the back of the head, and the big wolf goes down, completely still. In the next instant, Greta takes the man down and ends him before he can take another shot. Sam and Ty get in there and help tear him apart, even though he's dead now, and there are still 3 vampires standing. I can help with that part, so I do, not wanting any other wolves to get hurt. One by one, I unbind the surrounded vampires, then finish off the fallen ones. None of them will rise again. But this doesn't calm those younger werewolves down like I think it will. They're still far beyond the horizon of calm. And when they spot me standing there naked, with a pumping heart and meat on me bones, they come after me to have a bite. Bollocks, I say. I could handle a few of them, maybe, but not 9, and not without hurting them seriously. I can't fly away as a kite with me torn shoulder muscles, but bears can climb trees much better than wolves. Maybe I can climb high enough to keep me out of reach of their jaws. I shape-shift and muster what speed I can for the nearest ponderosa. The brass on me claws should help me climb 3-legged. Once I reach the tree, it's grand for a couple of seconds. I get up maybe 5 feet off the ground, but me arse is still low-hanging fruit for the pack. Claws and teeth sink in. Why shake a couple loose, but one will simply not let go, and I have to haul him or her up with me. Without the claws anchoring me to the tree and the strength it lends, I wouldn't have been able to do it, and I make a mental note to buy Crania a beer. Once I get me arms and chest around a branch high enough off the ground to be safe, I have to figure out how to get rid of the wolf attached to me arse. The simplest solution, which I use, is to shape-shift back to human. Part of that expansive backside just flows right over in between those teeth, and suddenly there's not enough purchase for him to hold on. The wolf falls, but takes a mouthful of me backside with him. The way a pack of young wolves collects around the base, they leap up to reach me, but can't quite make it. Safe, for the moment, if you don't count me chewed arse. I call to them. Greta! Sam! Tight! Owen! Can you get everybody calling down so we can talk? I'm not sure how much of that penetrates, if anything. Greta says it's tough to process spoken language when she's a wolf. The pack tends to communicate via their own link. And when they're far gone into the animal side, like during a full moon, or when the anger is running high, the human is pretty much gone. Right now we're at a half moon, so we should be fine, except the anger is about as raw as a wound you rub with salt and lemon juice. Looking over at where the big wolf fell, I understand why. The final shift is over, and that is indeed Hal Haup lying there, with the back of his head missing. Maybe that was the silver bullet the human used, and maybe not. Tough to survive a head wound like that. Either way, the rest of the wolves all race to the bottom of the tree and surround the base, snarling and snapping at me. I just keep hollering at Greta, Sam and Ty, hoping something will get through. It's grim and desperate shite, yelling at them and getting barks and growls in return. But keeping their attention here is better than letting them tear off through the woods so close to the city. They could wind up killing people out for an evening stroll. Or worse, go back into the house and see if they can get after what's in the basement. And my heart drops down to my guts as I realize how Greta's going to take this. Hal will be the second pack leader she's lost because of something she handed. Gunnar Magnusson was the one who turned her, but Hal was there when he did. She's known him since her old days in Iceland. I have little doubt that were she a Han here right now, she would try to kill him, and I fear that may be where she stands regarding him from now on. Nothing to be done about it. It's Sam who gets control first. His form begins to shudder, and then his bones slide and pop under the skin, and most of the hair falls out. And his howls turn into harsh screaming as his vocal tissues transform. Ty goes next. And the two of them start to exert their influence on the rest of the pack, calming them down. But Greta is having none of it. She leaves the tree and returns to Hal's body, snuffles a couple of times, then throws back her head and howls. Maybe if it was just an ordinary wolf doing its ordinary thing, I wouldn't care. But because I know who it is and why she's howling, it's the most terrible, lonely thing I've ever heard in me life. Part of me wants to join in, because we'd been having a good laugh together not 10 minutes ago. This had gotten so cocked up, so feckin' fast. Sam and Ty let her do her thing, while they get all the other wolves, either shifted or in the process of shifting. It's rough because they're roiled and haven't all torn into something, but the leader's commands have a powerful influence on them. Then they turn their attention to Greta, calling her name, and no doubt trying to reach her on the pack level too. But she shakes her head, rips out a few ragged barks, and takes off uphill, disappearing into the trees. I could chase after her, but I don't see the point. She has a lot of anger to work out, and she's going in the right direction to do it without hurting anyone. Putting myself forward as a target for that anger would be dangerous as well as foolish. She'll come back when she's ready, and I'm aware that it might not be for days. In the meantime, we have a feckin' mess to manage. I drop down from the tree and nod at Sam and Ty, who have blood on their faces. We walk together to where the human's body lays sprawled and mutilated. If Sam and Ty feel sick at being responsible for the tarn flesh and the blood on their mouths, in their mouths, they make no indication of it. Ty asks, "Are the kids safe in the basement?" "Aye, none of them were hurt."
"Good,"
Sam says.
"So who the hell was this?"
"I have an idea," I reply, "but I don't know for sure. He looks like someone Sheahan told me about. Might be the guy who put him in the hospital in Toronto." I squat down and pat through the shreds of his coat until I discover an Austrian passport. "Werner Droscher," I read aloud. "Yeah, this is the guy. Supposed to be the lover of the really old vampire Theophilus."
"Why is he here?"
"I don't think he'll be feckin' telling us."
"He lost the privilege of conversation when he started shooting."
Sam crouches down and picks up Drosh's gun, checking the ammo.
"Damn."
He drops it, as if stung.
"He's got silver. The others don't."
"He'd know, I suppose. I see a hole in Sam's side, and if that was a silver bullet, he'd be at death's door himself instead of walking around. Someone would have to dig that out of him before his skin closed over it. Accelerated healing can have that drawback against these modern weapons."
"Doesn't make sense to come in here with only one clip of silver rounds,"
Ty says. "It does, if you're traveling in a hurry and expecting only one werewolf instead of 14. I tell him, "I don't think ye were the target. I think they were after me, and knew that Greta would be here."
"Oh, you think this is that vampire war against druidry?"
"Aye, that's what I figure. Sheahan told me he was going to go around blowing shite up, and something like this might happen. I have wards on the house, but they never got close enough to trip him. And I didn't expect firearms. I'm sorry."
"Fuck!"
Sam swears.
"I have phone calls to make and a memorial service to arrange. And this isn't over. Killing a well-loved pack leader like that is going to have consequences."
"Wait," I said. "Let me help you with that bullet at least. And anyone else who got shot, I can maybe pull it out of there without digging around too much. The iron content makes it a challenge to bind those bullets to me palm, but not an insurmountable one, and it's better and faster than going in with tweezers. Nobody was facing the window directly when the bullets started flying, so most of the wounds are in the sides, arms and legs, and a few glanced off ribs. They'll all be fine in a few days, but no one's worried about that. We have to get dressed and look presentable before we bring the kids up out of the basement. And it falls to me and Ty to tell Meg and Tuya, through a translator, that Nergui got killed. It's really on me, but Ty feels some responsibility too. The pack, he says, should be represented and reassure them that they are still welcome and will be taken care of. I expect I'll lose Tuya as an apprentice. Even if she wants to continue, I'm not sure that's something Meg would want. People, understandably, want to avoid pain. And I think this house, especially the basement, will always be a source of pain for them. They might decide to forego the company of wolves and druids from now on, and I would not blame them. And Greta, when she comes back, might not be too fond of druids either. I fear them all so miserably. I'm not sure I want to keep my own company anymore."
Chapter 21. I'm not even a quarter of the tracker that Flittish is, and I didn't want to ask for her help finding Theophilus again, but I saw no other choice. She flatly refused to help, however, for the very good reason that shortly after helping me earlier, she heard that Fand had escaped her prison, and Mananon MacLear was most likely responsible.
Oh, I said. That's not good at all.
No. Finding her is my priority now.
It would be Briett's priority too, no doubt, and most likely Owen's, since he had a hand in imprisoning her. If I knew him at all, he was incandescently pissed at himself right now. He couldn't go around calling other people cock-ups if he made such a huge one himself. Perhaps Fan's escape and Mononon's disappearance would wind up becoming a priority of mine soon enough. But for the moment, I needed to end the vampire threat. 3 druids against tens of thousands of vampires was terrible odds, no matter our advantages. I was on my own again, and out of options. Except for a more personal one. Leif Helgerson had sent me into a death trap in Prague. It wasn't the first time he'd played me, and I doubted it would be the last, because I had a blind spot where he was concerned. Or maybe a stubborn resistance to thinking he really cared nothing for me during all those years he was my attorney and friend. The cold, rational thing to do would be to track him down and unbind him, to eliminate his ability to mess up my life anymore. But instead, I wanted to track him down and just beat the hell out of him. If there was, in fact, any hell at all to be beaten out. I was still not clear on the true nature of vampires, but had serious doubts that they were the creatures of hell that the Hammers of God and popular culture thought they were. To my knowledge, they were not truly repelled by crosses or holy water. To inflict real damage, you had to assault their centers of power, around the heart or head, or else burn them. Actual fire was best, but the sun would do. A nice, old-fashioned smackdown, though. Leif would shrug that off in a day, and I'd feel a whole lot better. But how to find him? He claimed to be in Normandy, which might or might not be true. But even if it was true, that didn't exactly give me his address. I couldn't find him via divination, but if he was in Normandy, perhaps I could find who would be his next meal. Someone staggering alone at night, drunk on Pinot Noir. And maybe if I asked Makira to help, she was far better at divination than I. She could track down Mananon and Fan in the bargain. I'd left Makira, the world's greatest tyromancer and infamous hermit, on Evan Ablah, the Isle of Apples, just before shifting to Toronto. She'd been the one to help me find that vampire directory, in return for removing her to a safe place where she wouldn't be bothered. I'd promised to tell Mononon she was there and ask him to take care of her. But I realized that I hadn't ever gotten around to that, and now he was missing. That gave me excuse enough to interrupt her solitude. She might actually need something, or Mononon might be there. Shifting to Evan Ablah meant that Oberon was reminded of his determination to make chicken apple sausage out of the rare apple varieties there, and the legendary vicious chicken of Bristol. He was trying to pin me down on where to find the best fennel and other spices for the Book of 5 Meats, as I called out for Makira. We had to circle halfway around the island before we got a response.
"Hello, Sheehan,"
she said, coming out of the trees.
"Back for another cheese?"
"Yep. Did you see me coming in advance?"
"No. Haven't been able to make a cheese since I got here, so no divination. Haven't seen this guard you told me would be dropping by either."
"Oh, I was gonna ask."
"What is it you want?"
"I'd like to know where that guard is, where a vampire will dine in Normandy tonight, and where to find an escaped goddess."
"Location, location, location. 3 questions, 3 cheeses. All right, go shopping for me, and that'll be payment enough."
"What do you need?"
"Only everything. I got out of Ethiopia with some vegetable rennet, but I lack dairy here, and all my other supplies. I'll make you a list."
"All right."
"I mean, as soon as you bring me paper and pen. I'm really starved for resources here, except apples. Unless it's safe for me to return to my home."
"Not yet. Just tell me what you need, and I'll remember." It was a very long list. That's gonna be a lot of shoplifting, I muttered, but she heard me.
You don't have any money,
Akira said.
I find that hard to believe.
If you go with me, I'll pay you back. She rolled her eyes.
You're determined to get me back into the world.
No, it's not that. I want to help, but I don't want to steal if I don't have to.
Let's go then. I'll reintroduce myself to my bank.
It was hours of errands after that, but Makira was efficient and knew what she wanted and where to get it. In addition to cheese-making paraphernalia, she picked up a few more outfits and plenty of food that wasn't apples. When she finally got started on her tiromancy, most of the day had burned away. In the pattern of the curdling cheese, she divined the future, the complex patterns revealing truth to her far more clearly than my wands ever could. She began with Fand.
She's not on Earth. A different plane. A castle, surrounded by a fen. Lots of yew trees. Creepy.
She'd taken up residence in the Morrigan's fen? At first, I was surprised that the Fae living there would permit it. Those loyal to the Morrigan tended to attack first and never question it later. Then I thought of a reason why they might, and privately bet that Mananon was there with her. Akira confirmed it with the next cheese.
He is in the same place.
It made sense. Now that the Morrigan was dead, Mananon had taken over her primary role as psychopomp, escorting the dead to whatever afterlife they had earned. The Fae there would accept him as the heir to the plane and protect him, and Fand as well, which I'm sure was her intention. The last cheese was a longer process, since we didn't have a name to look for. We instead needed to find a place in Normandy where someone would fall victim to sudden blood loss via the neck. That could mean we'd get a false positive, someone getting their throat slashed, but I was hoping slasher crimes weren't all that common in Normandy, or that there weren't a large number of vampires there.
It'll happen in Le Havre,
Akira said after studying the Kurds.
I can get an address. 7 Rue de Bretagne. It's not a house. Some kind of business. But I don't have a name for it.
When?
Very soon. Within the hour.
Anything about the victim? Male or female?
Male. Middle-aged.
Thanks. You are amazing, Makira. But I gotta go. I'll be in touch, I hope.
What?
You'll be fine. And I'll pay you back. It was an abrupt leave-taking, but I didn't want to miss Leaf. I'd have to shift to someplace outside the city and jog in, no doubt. And when I checked the bound trees nearby, sure enough, the closest one was miles out of town to the north. We have to move fast, Oberon, I said once we arrived. Stick with me and watch for cars when we cross streets.
What are you going to do?
He asked.
Is this going to be a duel?
I honestly don't know, I answered. Maybe. It'll be a reckoning. It took 20 minutes to get there, with a couple of quick stops to ask directions. The address turned out to belong to a restaurant that didn't cater to tourists. One either spoke French there or pointed at the menu. I walked right in with Oberon, shocking the sophisticants, dabbing at their lips with linen napkins.
Mon Dieu!
One man said, so startled by my hound's appearance that he dropped his fork into some delicate sauce, which splashed onto his lap.
Qu'est-ce que ce foutu gros chien fait ici?
Hey, did that guy just call me gross?
Oberon asked. Yes, but that means big in French, as it does in German. Leif wasn't in the restaurant, a fairly decent affair with 20 tables, though there were several middle-aged men enjoying wine. I pushed past a waiter and ignored the exclamations of the staff as I entered the kitchen. No vampire at the sous station, not hiding in the freezer either. The saucier got saucy with me and demanded that I leave, and I told him I was leaving so that he didn't try to escalate any further. I made for the back door, shouty chefs with kitchen implements trailing after me, and burst through into a dank alley with a foul trash bin and a couple of scooters parked nearby. A thud on the cobbled stones drew my eyes to the right, where I spotted the blonde-haired Leif Helgerson, who launched into a cover story in French upon being discovered.
Oh, thank God you're here. This man needs help. He just...
He stopped and switched to English.
Oh. Hello, Atticus.
Is he still alive?
For the moment.
I flicked my eyes to the trash bin. Behind a restaurant like this, they got emptied often and people expected a terrible smell. Great place to dump a body. A little fast food? Easily disposable? He ignored the question and asked,
How did you find me?
I ignored his question right back. Let's talk about why I went to the trouble. We were interrupted by the saucier coming outside to make sure I was gone. I shoved him back into the kitchen and slammed the door closed. But let's talk elsewhere. I've drawn attention to myself, and that's not good for either of us.
Agreed. There is a quay along the Bassin du Commerce. We should find privacy there.
All right. Switching to my mental link, I said, Keep me between you and Leif, Oberon. I don't want him deciding to take a swipe at you.
Whoa! You think he might?
I don't know. Let's be cautious.
We walked in silence out of the area and to the Quai Lombardier, where pedestrian traffic was light as long as we stayed away from the bridge spanning the basin. Sirens announced that Leif's victim had been discovered, most likely by the kitchen staff. And since they hadn't seen Leif, they would probably pin it on me, unless the wine-soaked man could tell them anything about Leif. I doubted he would. Leif had probably charmed him. The skies above Le Havre were clear as we walked along the quay, and in truth it was a beautiful night there. The Bassin du Commerce was a long and rectangular stretch of water designed to provide attractive reflections during the night and add value to the real estate ringing it, and perhaps to inspire romance between couples walking along it. Leif and I were not that kind of couple. I was inspired to punch him in the mouth, and he sensed it.
Your heart rate is elevated, and you're giving off many other signals of aggression, Atticus. Should I be worried?
Not terribly. I don't mean to unbind you anyway.
Don't give me a reason. Never fear. Continuing this existence is my primary goal.
And what are your other goals? Do you wish to see me dead?
Of course not. As the famous Vulcan said on more than one occasion, I wish for you to enjoy extreme old age and economic bounty.
What? That's not even close to how he said it.
Oh, I may have paraphrased. Does it matter?
Gosh, blow! Yes! You can't go around messing up Spock like that.
A pity. I thought I'd finally caught on to something cool there, in the sense that beans are cool, in the phrase, cool beans.
Oh, just shut up.
But the sentiment is true. I wish you only happiness.
I sincerely doubt it. That's just a phrase you stole out of the Machiavellian playbook.
I do beg your pardon, old friend, but I do not think you can judge me. Do you not have your own agenda? Do you not manipulate others to further your own ends?
I'm not even close to you in that regard. I don't betray people like you did me.
I am surprised you still harbor a grudge over a necessary step. Removing Zdenek was the only way to get where I am now, and you were the only way to remove him.
What? Where are you now? Feasting on winos in Le Havre? That's a step up for you?
I was not referring to my dining preferences. I meant I am in a position to remove Theophilus from power.
Oh, so that's what it was all about. You can frame it like you're doing the world a favor, but cut the shit. This is all about you.
Fair enough. But again, I must ask, how are you different? Are you not, even now, acting in your own self-interest? You can claim to be fighting the scourge of vampires on Gaia's behalf, but let us be honest. This is all about you. Gaia cares not whether we graze on the humans. We are no threat to her existence. So what you are doing is pursuing a personal vendetta against Theophilus. And I thought you would have learned a thing or two about revenge when we visited Asgard together.